From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Talk that matters. Germ Warfare and Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Germ Warfare at tntradio.live is my email address. Send me feedback, comments, questions, whatever you want. Germ Warfare at tntradio.live. Thank you for all the messages I have been receiving. It's great to know, as I've said before, that I am not speaking into a void. If you do listen to previous shows of mine, let me know what you think. Ask me questions, you know, because sometimes I get the guests back. It's actually very often that I do get some of the guests back for follow-up conversations. You can listen to previous conversations of mine by simply downloading the TNT app. It's the Google and Apple store. And I strongly recommend you do that because there are some phenomenally brilliant shows on TNT. And if you are new to TNT, it's 24-hour live radio that you can listen to anytime you want. And it's global. It's a great, great privilege to be able to broadcast from where I am. I'm in Cape Town. I'm at the bottom tip of the African continent. And here I am talking to you, wherever you are in the world. You know, it's an amazing thing. It really, really is. The weather today here in Cape Town is sunny. We are heading into summer. So the climate change memo is such that warmer weather is on its way. And speaking of, I suppose stormy weather, I'm going to be chatting about what's happening up in the Baltic Sea region in a moment. So let me do that. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare on TNT Radio.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I've been in the car all day and I got to listen.
Can't get enough of it.
You guys are doing a great job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Pepe Escobar, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Hi, how are you doing? Good evening from Thailand.
How's the weather in Thailand? I'm heading towards summer.
Well, we are at the end of the rainy season, so it's going to rain for the rest of October. It's been raining for 10 days nonstop, thunderstorms as well. But that's part of Thailand in October. You know, everybody knows that.
Is it beautiful where you are?
I could be in Vancouver. or some parts of New York City. I am surrounded by towers everywhere, and my right-hand neighbor is the Deutsche Bank Tower, where most people are out of a job. Most people are of a job, by the way.
So you aren't really in anything scenic. You're in sort of city center.
Yes, I live in here in Thailand. I live in the business district because it's I used to live at the Conrad Hotel across the street, so I would have my meetings. People would drop by, international travelers would drop by, and of course during COVID was a nightmare. It was totally empty. Sometimes I was the only guest, you know, for months. And here it's it's close to the airport. You have the best restaurants in Asia around you. And everybody drops in, and it's the place to have meetings. So it's convenient. I wish I was on the beach, but that's
impossible. I'm sure. you've traveled quite a lot, Pepe. Have you been to my side of the world?
Yes. In fact, I've been traveling nonstop since I became I'm part of a dying breed. I am one of the last foreign correspondents around. I started in 1985. So that was a long time. I was alone. You remember Frankie Goes to Hollywood?
Yes.
That's when I became a foreign correspondent. You remember their smash hit Two Tribes? They had an MTV video with Reagan and Gorbachev. That was a major hit at that time, you know. Well, this is when I became a foreign correspondent in London, of all places.
You're showing your age, Pepe.
Yes, I do. I I am an old guy, but I don't give a fuck, you know, so it's fine.
You mentioned Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Wasn't he the one who did that other one? Relax, Don't Do It.
Yeah, Relax. Oh, yeah. I used to DJ Relax. Relax was in 1983, 84. At the time, I was working like hell and DJing at night. And Frankie was one of my favorites, by the way.
Just quickly, before we chat about serious stuff, I asked you a moment ago, yes. Have you been to my side of the world, down here at the bottom tip of Africa?
Oh, man, I love South Africa. You know that it's a crazy story. After 9-11, in fact, before 9-11, I was in Afghanistan. I was in Pakistan, tribal areas, Afghanistan. And then I needed a quiet place to write a series about Afghanistan. This was a few days before 9-11. Of course, we didn't know anything about it. We knew that something might happen. This is what I had learned in Peshawar when I came back from Afghanistan. And we published that story on August 30th. And then I went to Brazil for a few days via South Africa. So I stayed in Johannesburg for 3 days and I said, why I don't stay here? But then some people are calling me in Brazil. So I went to Brazil. So when 9-11 happened, I was in Brazil writing my Afghan story. So the next week I was back to Pakistan via South Africa.
Okay, well, so you have a little bit of African in you. So that's a good start for me.
oh man, of course. I miss it. My last major trip was backpacking in Western Africa. But that was 20 years ago, you know. So, but at the time, like, I've seen stuff that later on would ring many bells. For instance, Wahhabi madrasas in the middle of nowhere in Mali. So after 9-11, you start connecting a few dots, like this one, for instance.
Yeah. Well, let's connect some more dots. I need your help here, Pepe. So let me start with the basics. Yeah, let's start with the absolute basics. Why is Nord Stream significant?
Oh, that's a very, very long story. So let me start our conversation with breaking news. For all of you. It's not a scoop because this has been admitted by Gazprom, I think 2 days ago. But the first one who mentioned that was the Russian Deputy Prime Minister, Alexander Novak. He said that, if I'm not mistaken, on Saturday. He said, no, we can have the both Nord Streams back. It's a question of a political will. First, we need to identify the culprits. But we can have them back in less than 6 months. Okay. Slightly afterwards, Gazprom, and I call a contact linked to Gazprom in Moscow. I said, I need a confirmation from Gazprom that they can recover Nord Stream 2 or both pipelines. And I got something even better, a confirmation that Nord Stream 2, line B, there are two lines on each one of them, you know, has not been touched by the terror attack. So this means of the two lines of Nord Stream 2, one is intact. The other one can be recoverable, but the line B is totally intact. What does that mean? That if we have political will, Germany can have gas tomorrow. Simple as that. The pipeline is ready. And when the pipeline was bombed, it was filled with gas. And Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, said that on the record, we were ready to go. So they lost all that gas. And of course, they lost a lot of money because of the gas that was inside both Nord Streams. But Nord Stream 2, line B, considering it can be put back together like this week, this is a major, major game changer. And Bloomberg yesterday more or less confirmed that. And even some of my readers are connecting the dots. Like, you know, the column that I published yesterday, one of my readers said exactly what I'm telling you guys. He identified that. He also, and just by reading the Bloomberg article. But now we have an official confirmation by Gazprom that Nord Stream line B of Nord Stream 2 is intact. So so the perpetrators, whoever they are, no, because we know more or less who did it. But the way they did it, they are incompetent enough to not bomb a pipeline properly, which fits right. Their Three Stooges profile, doesn't it?
So one of them actually technically is working and the other isn't.
Well, the thing is, Nord Stream 1 and 2, Nord Stream, not the original Nord Stream, both lines, and one island or Nord Stream 2, they were bombed. For instance, Gazprom would not say how, because this is a state secret in Russia. SVR, Russian Foreign Intel, they know exactly what happened, but obviously they're not going to tell anybody. Now, Western public opinion, other governments, even friendly governments, I think they won't even tell the Chinese about that. But they know what.
Why?
So, because this is a state secret, Jeremy. First of all, they need to conduct. They know. Let's see. By Russian satellites and electronic surveillance, they know what happened. What they don't have is on-site evidence. And that will be even more difficult for the Russians because the Swedish and the Danish, they isolated the area. So basically only the Swedes and some Danish. This looks like one of those Scandi Noir series on Netflix, you know. So the Swedish and the Danish monopolize the crime scene. Nobody can get in, you know. So it's a crazy thing because it's NATO investigating NATO. And aspiring NATO, in the case of Sweden, investigating NATO. We all know this. This is what this is going to be. This is going to be another MH17 episode. You know, so nobody apart from NATO will trust the intra-NATO investigation, especially because of all the different hypotheses that we have at the moment of the whodunit of the whole story. For many of us, and this is something we have been discussing among analysts and journalists, not only Russians involved, Europeans as well, and even Americans, the number one working hypothesis, I would like to stress that, this is very important, because we don't have all the evidence we need, is that this was an intra-NATO operation against Germany. And who was involved? The Polish, via Polish Navy and their special forces, the Americans for the overall planning, green light, conducting satellites, you name it, like aerial surveillance from the Sigonella NATO base in Sicily, etc. And the Swedes and the Danish, because they let it happen. Don't forget that this happened very close to their exclusive economic zones, but that was very well calculated in international waters. Very, very close, a matter of a few nautical miles, you know. So nobody theoretically, no government theoretically will be involved with a terror, with an act of terror inside their own maritime borders. So this is our working hypothesis number one. There's another hypothesis that is circulating a lot in the US that this was a torpedoes launched from a Navy P-8 bomber. But this is slightly more far-fetched than hypothesis number one. And number three, of course, is underwater drones, which is quite feasible considering the Brits were exercising in the area in July. The Americans had exercised in the area as well. NATO sent they issued a tweet on the day of the bombing saying that there were underwater exercises near the island of Bornholm. So this is a very credible hypothesis as well. So as you can see, we have three major hypotheses as it stands. So can you imagine an intra-NATO investigation going to the literally to the depths of all these three hypotheses? No, you know, impartial analyst can believe that. So and the Russians, of course, now that they learned that they cannot send their own team to the area. because they need a permit. Can you believe this thing? The Swedes came up, they came up with an idea yesterday. Ah, you need to wait for 20 days for a permit so you can come to the area. Obviously, in 20 days, they can erase all sorts of evidence we can imagine, right? So this is where we stand at the moment. Even with the game changer of Nord Stream 2, let's say ready to go, if there is political will. But the thing is, nothing will happen before the results of this, between commas, NATO investigation on itself. And that's
what so ridiculous, Pepe.
I agree, so Jeremy. This is what we've been discussing for the past 24 hours. Absolutely.
NATO investigating NATO. What could possibly go wrong? Pepe, don't go anywhere. Yeah, hold on, Pepe. I have to quickly go to an ad break. I'll be back with you now.
You should hear what Mark Morano is talking about.
There are calls throughout Europe, Canada, the United States, Australia, and the once free West to nationalize all these energy industries. We'll start with that. Why is that? Well, because the free market failed. Look at this. We have shortages. We have high prices. We have people scrounging for firewood in Europe. We have, in fact, the most insane article this week was Yahoo Finance. Firewood is the new gold. Prices shift and theft jump in Europe as Russia's gas cutoff boosts wood demand ahead of winter. 1,000% increase in European energy prices. Another article, New York Times, crippling energy bills force Europe's factories to go dark. Now, we've talked on this program before about what is causing these shortages. And it is the Green New Deal. It is the net zero. It is the United Nations. It is the World Economic Forum climate goals, which have been choking off energy for decades in Europe. They're further ahead in the United States. And this is where we're headed now rapidly in the United States.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing. We can build that. Sustainable housing. We can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Pepe, we were just laughing a moment ago about the absurdity of NATO investigating NATO. But something I saw on CNN is that they accused Russia of blowing up its own pipeline. I mean, come on, that's also a working hypothesis, is it not?
Of course, this is the working hypothesis of sore loser incompetent generals like Petraeus. And this is something I witnessed Petraeus losing a surge in Iraq and then losing a surge in Afghanistan a few years later. This is one of the most incompetent. Okay, I ran out of adjectives about Petraeus, but we know him. People who cover the empire around the world. The Americans, of course, they only get spinned from people like that. And especially Petraeus on CNN is perfect because he can say anything absolutely stupid, and there'll be nobody to say you're lying. So if he tries to say that in Europe or here in Asia, he, you know, he would be crucified, absolutely. But of course, this is the number one deep state neocon, neoliberal con cycle across the beltway. Not theory, according to them, evidence. Russia did it. And you cannot have a rational argument with these people, of course, trying to prove to them that why Russia, who is an expert in strategic ambiguity and strategic death, would blow up the best leverage that they have in their negotiations with Europe. No, first of all, because they don't understand any of these concepts. And first of all, they don't understand how the Russians think. So this will go on because and it gets much worse, Jeremy, because now they are not only solidifying with American public opinion that Russia did it, they are going to get this together with a NATO investigation with some bogus evidence out of nowhere. And then they're going to have an official investigation corroborating their, not hypothesis, their lack of evidence, in fact. So this will get much worse in the next 2 or 3 weeks, in fact. And they, it's relentless because now they are much more desperate because, don't forget, we are approaching the midterms. They know via their military sources. When I say they, I mean the Pentagon, essentially. They know that the special military operation, the status of the special military operation is going to change. It's going to become a CTO. A counter-terrorist operation because of the referendums and what I call the four baby bears. They are now part of the Russian Federation. So any attack on the four baby bears will be an attack on Mother Russia. And you can imagine the Russian reaction. Those idiots, those the neocons, neoliberal cons, Straussians, any way you want to define them, total cycles at the State Department, etc. Obviously, they don't understand that. But the guys at the Pentagon, they do. And that's why they are very much scared, because this will be, if we, the discussion, to give an idea to all the listeners, the discussions in the Russian military channels on Telegram, everybody, all the best military analysts that they have and their reporters on the ground in Donbass, they say, no, look, now it's time to really get the hammer down. This is a consensus. And Putin, even though he is a diplomat, essentially, and he's very legalistic, he cannot go against the advice of his top military experts, in fact, and the top military analysts on the terrain who keep feeding information from the terrain to people in Moscow. This is something that doesn't happen in the US, but it's normal in Russia. You have embedded military correspondents. And they exchange information with those people in the offices in Moscow or St. Petersburg or headquarters in Rostov, for instance. And the military, they listen to them. They listen to the guys on the ground. And everybody's saying the same thing. Look, that's it. We are retreating for the moment because we don't have enough manpower, enough weapons. So we need more weapons, we need more manpower, which is going to happen in the next few weeks, and we need to go for the kill, go for the jugular, which is what's going to happen probably starting in the next few weeks. And obviously, in Kiev, they are more or less, because of their enormous network of informers, of course, they are aware of that, and they are freaking out. And the generals in the Pentagon are also freaking out. So we're going to see a major game changer, I would say, between November and December. And we, this is the lull before the storm. Absolutely.
So this is just the start, what's going on now.
Yes. Yes. It hasn't even started, Jeremy. In fact, we are back to that famous Putin comment. A little over a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, when he says, we haven't even started yet. And they haven't. They haven't. The point is, if we look at the big picture, What did they accomplish in roughly 7 months? They incorporated four very, very important regions to the Russian Federation. This is over 5 million people. Depending on how you count it, could be anything from 60 to 90% of Ukraine's GDP. Virtually the whole Ukrainian industrial base, which is in Donbass. So, and they did this with using what? Half a hand and half a foot, maybe.
20%, I think I heard.
Yes, there are different numbers, Jeremy, but everything from 10% to 20%. You're right. I think that the military numbers circulating with the Russian military channels is 15%, which is nothing.
Yeah, that's, you know. And it's nothing. Nothing.
It's nothing. And they didn't use their best weapons. They used exactly. They were using very old tanks. So then you see American, American generals on CNN. Oh, their tanks are ridiculous. Of course, because they only used old stuff that they needed to get rid of.
That's such a big middle tank, finger, isn't it?
Yes, it's completely absurd. The T-90 tanks. They're starting to introduce them now. In fact.
Sure.
And those Tarantino-style flamethrowers from hell, now they're going to be all over the place, the Buratino, including the famous Buratino, which is the so-called weapon from hell. You don't want to be in front of a Buratino when it hits.
No.
Pepe. Yes, go ahead.
I have to quickly go to news headlines, and then we'll carry on right after that.
With a quick look at your TNT headlines, I'm Matt Boyland. A former US Marine has been sentenced to 4.5 years in a Russian prison for assaulting a police officer while drunk. The European Union's Food Safety Agency has warned a new dangerous strain of the bird flu is sweeping across the European continent at an unprecedented rate, and large parts of Australia are again staring down the barrel of yet another potentially devastating flood event, with more than a month's worth of rain set to fall on already saturated catchments over the coming days.
Do you have a suggestion for a possible guest or host that you'd like to hear on TNT Radio?
Or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss?
Then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
Pepe, can I just see if I'm following your hypothesis, your working hypothesis? So basically, what you're saying is that you had the Polish Navy and, of course, its own sort of special forces acting as the actual physical perpetrators, right, of the sabotage of the pipeline. Then you had the Americans, such as, I don't know, the CIA and maybe people in the White House who are part of the planning and the technical support of that sabotage. And then perhaps aided by Danish and, did you say, Swedish military?
Exactly. Because it's very close to their waters. One thing, it's very, very important, Jeremy. The White House probably was bypassed in all that.
I
had some serious conversations with my dissident sources in the Beltway, retired people who know everything that's going on inside the Beltway. Some still active, but they are dissident. People who aren't in the financial business, but they have their intel connections. And they more or less agreed that the teleprompter reader had no fucking clue what was going on. And it makes sense. Because first of all, Jeremy, he doesn't know in which room he is and who's going to shake hands afterwards. Everybody knows that. Even kids in Burkina Faso know that because they see it on the net. Everybody knows that. So who is deciding this really heavy foreign policy stuff? It's the combo behind. And then we see the National Security Council, of course, perhaps not all of them, but the predominant faction. We see the Straussians in government, in the State Department. This means Blinken, Sherman, and Nuland, numbers 1, 2, and 3.
She doesn't like the European Union.
Well, Newland, okay, Newland has been at the heart of this whole thing even before Maidan in 2014. So, in fact, Newland, she's much more forceful than Blinken. It's very, very funny. You know, one day I was I got to tell you this because it's very, very funny. I was at a conference with Eduard Luttwak, which is, probably the number one American strategist for the past few decades. And I asked him about Blinken. He said, yeah, I knew him when a long time ago. He's a nice boy. That's it. So, nice boy Blinken. In front of a Victoria Nuland, which is like a Panzer division, you know, obviously, you know. So Nuland is deciding everything in conjunction with the psycho-neocons of the Robert Kagan variety, her husband, by the way. So these are the people who are driving the policy. And because they have so many... Yes, go ahead.
I'm so sorry for interrupting, but Joe Biden himself said... in a press conference that that the US can stop Nord Stream.
Exactly.
I know that Joe Biden, I know that he can't be taken seriously, but I mean, is he not part of the White House?
He is, but look, this is why he said months ago. Nowadays, his cognitive abilities are extremely diminished, according to people in Washington who see them on and off. And in terms of foreign policy decisions, he doesn't decide anything anymore for a while now because he can't. Mm. And he doesn't even understand. For instance, how to explain to Biden the complexity of these Russian moves one after another, calling a referendum, yeah. Calling a partial mobilization. What does that mean legally? Geopolitically, geoeconomically, etc. How Russian diplomats are dealing with the European Union. It's impossible for him to understand in considering his state at the moment. So the people behind, the two people we need to keep focusing on are Sullivan and Blinken, dumb and dumber. It's up to you guys to decide who's dumber. But Sullivan is very, very dangerous because he's the quiet type. He's not like Blinken. But these key decisions at a National Security Council level, they are taken by Sullivan. And Blinken, of course, the decisions are taken by Nuland in the State Department. Together, this is a very, very toxic alliance. And because, once again, because they have these silos everywhere, National Security Council, State Department, CIA, Pentagon, etc. It's easy for them to have allies and, of course, think tanks disseminating what they're doing. It's crazy. I receive in my inbox every day a toxic sludge of American think tanks. And just looking at the headlines, it's amazing. It's like one guy wrote the press release and distributed to all of them on the Russia-NATO war, especially. And, of course, on the anti-China war via Taiwan. It's exact, and it's the same words, you know, the same headlines, you name it, you know. So that's what makes it so dangerous, because there is a consensus among all these cycles together in Washington on how to inflict pain or damage to Russia. And obviously, you are dealing in Russia with people like Patrushev, the head of their Security Council, who is a Yoda. Patrushev is really, really hardcore. You know, he can eat Blinken as he already did. He eats Blinken for breakfast, lunch, you name it. Just like his equivalent in China, Yang Jiechi. Yang Jiechi made shark fin soup of Tony Blinken last year when they met in Alaska, you know. So you have people that are extremely mediocre dealing with super pros like this trio in Russia. Patrushev at the Security Council, Naryshkin at SVR, Foreign Intelligence, the guys from the FSB and the guys from the GRU, Military Intelligence. It's a joke. It's a joke. And the Russians already know what the Americans are going to say, even before they say it. And because they play what we call strategic ambiguity, Russian style. The Americans never know their next move. So that's why, for instance, they have to come up with this campaign. The current campaign that we're suffering now is that Russia is going to use tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. This is absolute bullshit. Number one, because in the Russian military doctrine, they never use weapons unless they are attacked physically. This is explicit in their military doctrine. Unlike the Americans, they can do first strike. Russia will never do a first strike. What Putin has been saying this in many of his key speeches. If the integrity of the Russian Federation is threatened, we can respond with all the means that we have. And obviously, if you know how to read, you understand that this includes their formidable nuclear arsenal. This is not going to happen. Of course not. And if they use a tactical nuclear weapon, like the Americans are saying, in the Black Sea, the Ukrainian and Russian populations who live close by will be affected. The Russians are not like that. The Russians don't do shock and awe, for instance. The Russians don't invade the country and destroy everything. Like the Americans did in Iraq in 2003. I saw it. I was there. What they might be considering doing is that, considering that from now on, Kiev may continue to attack subjects of the Russia Federation, which means the four baby bears. And there is... This is, for the moment, it's in the air, but there may be an ultimatum in the next few days handed by Moscow to Kiev. Say, look, if you keep bombing our four new territories, you're going to pay for it with everything, including your lives. So that's it. So these are the terms of your surrender, essentially. This is what they're going to tell Kiev. So Kiev, because there's no Kiev, it's NATO. It's NATO sitting in Kiev. They're going to say no. And we go back to what we were discussing about the Pentagon generals. They know that this could be the next step. And there's nothing the Pentagon, the Americans, NATO, or anybody can do against a kind of Russian shock and awe, the whole of Ukraine. And then I mean what happened in Iraq in 2003. Everything goes dark. A new attack. Every major important infrastructure node. So at the moment, this is a hypothesis once again. But now it's more and more probable because Putin is under pressure internally for that. Virtually everyone is saying the hammer must come down. So we better get ready because this is going to happen in the next few weeks.
What does that hammer symbolize? What does it mean?
At this stage, Jeremy, metaphorically, because the Russians would never say we're going to apply shock and awe Russian style. what they can say is we're going to start a comprehensive attack on the infrastructure of Ukraine. This is how they will put it diplomatically. Even Lavrov, in one of his briefings, can probably say something along these lines, you know. And this is what's being discussed, a comprehensive attack on all major infrastructure nodes of Ukraine. So after that, and that would include, of course, it's a possibility, decapitation of the Kiev leadership. Today I received a list from one of the Russian Telegram channels of what's being discussed. Wow. And it's really, really hardcore. And it goes even beyond that, you know. So this is what the really hardcore guys want. And I would include among these really hardcore guys, the head of the FSB, Naryshkin, the head of the SVR, and the head of the military intelligence. So you put these guys together in the same table with Putin. Putin is outnumbered because his legalistic approach doesn't work anymore.
And that's the thing. Putin is very legalistic. He follows the rules.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. Because he knows he has to deal with the rules-based international order afterwards. So everything that he does is strictly according to the law, in fact. And even he justified the beginning of the special military operation in February as following. Basically, he was justifying more or less along the same lines that the Americans justified Libya, a kind of a Russian version of responsibility to protect, which it was. So the Americans got away with that in Libya. Don't forget that. The Americans got away with that in the UN Security Council. The Russians didn't have to go that far. They could and they can easily prove that there was a mini genocide in the making against the populations of Donbass. Because if you look at the numbers of the shelling against Donbass a few days before the start of the special military operations, they went from 4, 5, 10 to 2,000 a day. So this was the NATO provocation. This was the American NATO provocation. We're going to provoke the Russians to do something. So tactically, they succeeded in this first round on a tactical level. I'm not sure they will prevail strategically, because Russia thinks strategically. The Americans don't. Yes, go ahead.
Pepe, I have to quickly do my last ad break. I'll be back with you now.
Can we legislate better weather? Climate activists seem to think so.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Hurricane Ian slammed into Florida this week, and you know what that means. Politicians claiming legislation and pork barrel spending can change extreme weather and reduce storms. Here's U.S. Senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, just a few years ago explaining how we can lessen hurricanes.
If we would do more on climate change, we'd have fewer of these hurricanes and other types of storms. Everyone knows that, except a few.
I'm sorry. Everyone knows you can legislate the weather and climate? Make no mistake. This is a return to medieval witchcraft. We now blame bad weather on our SUVs and our thermostat controls in our home. But back then, we blamed bad weather and crop failure on those witches. The majority of the judges at the Salem witch trials were educated at Harvard. Just goes to show you, the more things change, the more they stay the same. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative, this is Viewpoint.
Natural disasters may seriously threaten civilization in the future, yet the mainstream media peddles a pseudo-scientific man-made climate crisis. Natural climate change is a real threat, and historical records show that global cooling is the biggest killer, not global warming. Cooling may arise from astronomic phenomena, including solar cycles. And volcanic activity can play a major role too. For example, in 1815, Mount Tambora in Indonesia underwent the most deadly volcanic eruption in recorded history. Enormous amounts of dust and ash destroyed crops and vegetation, killed tens of thousands of people, and the eruption led to tsunamis. The following year, 1816, was known as the Year Without a Summer, as abundant frost and ice continued all year. Newspapers of the day reported extensive crop failures in Europe and the United States.
When you need to know what's going on around the world and at home, keep it on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Pepe, who benefits from sabotaging Nord Stream?
Well, of course, number one, two, three, four, five, ten, a million, the Americans, because this was their policy from the beginning when Nord Stream 2 was still being built. So this didn't start earlier this year or after the start of the SMO. No, this started years ago, because the Americans know that with Nord Stream 1 and 2. Not only Germany, but many other important EU nations would have secured a lifeline of cheap energy with the Russians for the foreseeable future. And from the point of view of an empire in distress, this is anathema. So everything that is going on in the whole sanctions dementia matrix, let's put it this way, at the heart of this matrix is disabling Nord Stream 2. They tried everything, of course. And the last resort, which a pretty desperate measure, was this 9/11 underwater. In fact, this is how I described it in my column yesterday. This is the 9/11 of the 2020s. And it's obviously, it's clumsy. 9/11 at least was not exactly clumsy. It was extremely well planned, and the execution was practically faultless, apart from building number 7, of course. That's another story.
Yes.
But this one, it was a sloppy operation, because after 2 or 3 days, you already know who did it and why, and with the motive on top of it. It's a matter of choosing which of the working hypotheses that we have at the moment, you know, and especially the motive. Even Europeans that are not brainwashed, in Europe is a disaster. I live part-time in Europe. And the brainwashing of the average German, Frenchman, Italian, it's something that I never saw in my life, and I've seen a lot of shit as a correspondent for almost 40 years. You know, it's unbelievable, and it's impossible to have, like, you know, the conversation that we're having now, or the conversation that you can have in a network that is not Western, Chinese, or Russian, Iranian, Pakistani, Turkish, etc. It's absolutely impossible in the West nowadays. Absolutely, because the campaign is monstrously efficient, very, very efficient. People don't even dare to come up with a different interpretation of anything that they see every day in their newscasts and front pages. And of course, everything from Russia is blocked. Every solid information or analysis from Russia is blocked. And in the case of Western reporters, journalists, or analysts who try to explain what's being decided in Russia, all of us, we are completely blocked in the West, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter. And in the case of many websites, they are blocked from the net as well, or they are suffering attack all the time. So it's I've never seen anything like it, and it's this is what neo-Orwellianism looks like.
Yes.
We are living it in our daily lives, and it's insidious, because it's even separating best friends, separating families, you name it, you know, the effects are, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's also creating new allies and new friendships, isn't it?
Yes, it is, especially like, you know, the spectacularly important, I would say, summit of the SEO in Samarkand last month. You know, I was in Uzbekistan 1 month before, including Samarkand, traveling around, canvassing the terrain. This means, you know, getting back to the heart of the heartland, which is the Silk Roads in Samarkand, Bukhara, and the revival, and making a connection with the revival of the Silk Roads nowadays, driven by the Chinese, by the Russians, and by the Iranians, the Pakistanis, the Indians as well. And they all got together in Samarkand.
Bricks.
Exactly. They all got together in Samarkand last month, which was an informal meeting of the SEO with everybody else, with the BRICS as well, with the people who are in the Chinese New Silk Roads, but also in the Eurasian Economic Union, which is driven by Russia. They all got together in Samarkand discussing this very complex process of the emergence of a multipolar world, and the emergency, in fact, of bypassing the US dollar and creating an alternative economic financial system. All of that was discussed in depth in Samarkand. And it keeps on going. You know, there are different working teams. And this is something I discuss with Michael Hudson all the time. In fact, you know, how to organize this parallel or alternative currency, how is it going to be backed, Is it going to be backed by commodities or gold, by bulls? Mm. Who's going to control that? What are the mechanisms that they're going to use? Something similar to the special drawing rights of the IMF. So all these very important players, major global South actors, all of them, they are doing everything they can to, that's it, the American free lunch is over, but we need to come up with our own our own dinner, you know, and made by us, it's going to be eaten by us, and we're going to distribute, and everybody's going to sit at our table. It's not for an elite, and it's not only for one player in the case of the Americas. So this is all evolving at the same time, in parallel to this horrendous battlefield skirmishes and hardcore First World War style in Ukraine. And the Russians are now starting to get a grasp of, look, we have two options. We can have this thing lasting forever, and we don't care, because we can still be doing it with 15% of our, and we are still making money. We're making, our economy is still okay. Gazprom is making a lot of money in oil and gas. Or we can decide to go for the juggler and end this thing in a matter of a few weeks. This is where they are at the moment, you know, and then concentrate on what really matters, which is how to build the new multipolar Eurasia-centered world.
Pepe, we've got less than 5 minutes.
Okay.
So what I'd like from you, perhaps, is just a quick prognosis. What do you see playing out?
Jeremy, I hate crystal balls. You know, we deal with reality. I deal with facts. I need confirmations of facts. I need to study where the facts are leading us. So prognosis is it's a tricky business, isn't it? And none of us has a crystal ball. Who would have thought that on February 24 we would have the beginning of a new world, in fact, in a kinetic way, né? Because the Russians decided that's it, we had enough. This is something they could have done in 2014. They didn't because they weren't ready at the time. This is something they had been postponing for quite a while. They tried every possible form of dialogue with the Americans, including the most important thing, which happened at the end of last year, when they sent those letters to Washington, basically saying, look, let's sit down and discuss a new security arrangement for Europe, Eastern Europe, and our Western borderlands. And we all know what happened. They got a non-response response, which was basically a non-response. So they were ready. They knew that something was coming. And when they saw what's going on the terrain, in the line of control on the Kiev side facing Donbass, when they heard Zelensky say at the Munich Security Conference that Ukraine was thinking about getting back to their nuclear weapons program, and when they knew about all those bioweapons, American bioweapons labs in Ukrainian territory, they had three casus belli in one to act. And that's why they acted now. And of course, because now Putin felt secure that he had all the weapons that he needed. Maybe, and this is very important, he had faulty intelligence on the real state of the Russian armed forces, at least the ones that they've been using so far. And this is something that the Russians themselves are discussing among themselves. They say, look, our best troops are not part of this thing. Otherwise, we could have ended it in a matter of a few weeks. So they sent, they sent a small force, not first class and on the cheap, because the Ministry of Defense probably told Putin, we can do it. And obviously, it was not enough. And that's why the great thing is that they learn from their mistakes. Now they're changing tack and now changing the status of the military operation to a counter-terrorist operation. Then they can unleash, you know, a real highway to hell, AC/DC style. Yeah. On the other side. You
know. Okay, Pepe, I'm almost out of time. I'll give you 20 seconds. Where, okay. 20 seconds. Where can I follow your work?
Yes, so for the moment, I am at Hybrid World with Asia Times. I've been working with them for 20 years, so I don't know what's going to happen next. So you can read me on The Cradle, based in Beirut, Strategic Culture, based in Moscow, and a lot of people who republish my stuff. Among them, in the US, The Saker in Florida, UNS Review in California, Global Research in Canada, Zero Hedge in New York, New Jersey. Yep. So plenty of options.
Pepe Escobar, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure indeed. All right. Thank you for listening. Fascinating conversation. I actually am hoping I'm going to get Pepe back because he has such a good insight. Thank you, Luke, for keeping this hour going smooth. I'll be back with you after the news. My name is Jerm. This is Jerm Warfare on TNT Radio.